never let a good crisis go to waste. There's a bit of debate about whose quote that is. Was it Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel? Was it Winston Churchill? Machiavelli? Jared Henderson? Who knows? Whoever said it, the sentiment there, it's alive and well. According to my next guest, both Russia and China see strategic opportunity in the current situation, in this pandemic. Should we be suspicious? How is Vladimir Putin in particular responding as the pandemic spreads across his own country? We've seen what has happened in China. To discuss this, I'm joined by Keir Giles. Keir is a senior consulting fellow of the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House in the UK. He had a book in 2019 entitled Moscow Rules, What Drives Russia to Confront the West. Keir, thank you for joining us.
Good evening. Hello.
News reports in this part of the world just today of naval goings on in the South China Sea. It's clear that geopolitics has not gone into isolation. It's very much business as usual out there.
That's absolutely right. It would be strange if both Russia and China weren't looking for opportunities when Western countries are weakened and distracted, so caught up in the pandemic that they may not be necessarily paying as close attention as they should be to what's going on worldwide. And you mentioned President Putin. Certainly in the early stages of the pandemic, everybody was watching very closely increased Russian military activity, including probing flights by aircraft, missions by submarines, to see if this was actually trying something new. More recently, of course, as you said, Putin has been diverted by coronavirus hitting Russia hard, and so that seems to have quietened down a little.
We saw in the 2016 election, of course, famously Russian interference in the lines of communication in the United States, particularly around things like social media. Are we seeing that again as various mixed messages are put about the pandemic?
Well, it's not so much again as still. It's worth thinking about Russian disinformation efforts not as an event but as a process. It was ongoing before the 2016 election. It's been ongoing since. It mutates and it transforms and it has different targets at different times, but it is always there. And one of the common themes that is persistent throughout Russian messaging, whether it's in our time or whether it's during the communist period or even before that during Tsarist times, because this is a permanent feature of what Russia does, is trying to undermine the faith of liberal democratic societies in their own institutions and in their own governments. So a lot of the messaging that we've seen, for example, around Russian outreach efforts, like delivering the healthcare equipment that they themselves so desperately need to Italy, is presenting it as, look, the Italian government is failing, the EU is failing, actually it's Russia that is coming to save you. And this is a recurring theme all the way through what Russia seeks to convince Western publics about.
And that process, that project of undermining institutions, of creating that sense of national doubt, it's going pretty well.
Well, a lot of the time Russia rides trends instead of inventing them. Of course, there wouldn't be such fertile ground for some of these campaigns to have such success if there wasn't already a certain amount of distrust in Western institutions. And of course, let's look at the United States. They're doing quite well at tying themselves in knots at the moment without any external help. But the coronavirus pandemic, it really is the golden moment for disinformation, because there is this uncertainty. There's this lack of faith in actual objective information and differing opinions coming from different experts. So inject into that more fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and it's not surprising it takes off.
The objectives and interests of China and Russia in this, I mean, do they merge? Do they overlap? Are they entirely distinct?
There's always overlap, but they do have different end objectives. In fact, the striking thing is the way in which some of their campaigns have been so similar, this combination of delivering aid, whether or not it's of any quality or use, and at the same time a disinformation campaign, is a tactic that both of them have adopted, but they do want very different end results from it. China's looking for a leadership position and for soft power and improving its image in the world, and of course it wants a sustainable world economy at the end of it, because that's what its own recovery depends on. Russia, meanwhile, is the wrecker. So they're looking for very different outcomes. They're looking for undermining the whole of the rules-based international order that they think works against them. But they're going about it in strikingly similar ways.
And as China becomes, and potentially the other side of this, becomes increasingly powerful, increasingly influential, at what point do those two campaigns go head to head? Does it not, you know, Russia and China going toe to toe, aiming their strategies at each other?
Well, that's a moment that everybody has been waiting for a while. But Russia is incredibly careful not to offend China. They can insult the West all they like because they know there are going to be no costs or consequences for pretending that the United States is about to invade them and that NATO is a hostile actor, etc. But there's no even hint of China being a problem in any of their public declarations or their strategic documents, their military doctrine, national security strategy, etc. If you read all of those, it's as though China didn't exist because they know that the relationship is such an unequal one that they will immediately suffer political and diplomatic and economic pain just like anybody else if they find themselves criticizing China or suggesting that there's even a hint of a problem in the relationship. Longer term, of course, that's not sustainable because the trajectories of the two countries are so diverse, they can't both pretend to be great powers at the same time.
You've mentioned, Kiev, what Russia has been doing in Italy through the pandemic. Can you go into a bit of detail there, exactly how Russia became involved in the Italian situation with COVID-19?
Well, how exactly they became involved is a pretty good question because it seems to have happened really without the Italian government possibly even noticing what was going on. Suddenly, at the beginning of April, you had Russian military vehicles and Russian military units being delivered by Russian military aircraft into a NATO country and then apparently taking over part of the mission of fighting the pandemic. And it's interesting what was actually sent, not in fact healthcare units, but chemical, biological and radiological protection units. So the kind of equipment that you would use for disinfecting buildings or, decontaminating buildings and vehicles and aircraft on a mass scale as opposed to actually actually providing care for individuals. So there, it's not exactly clear what to what extent this was coordinated and agreed with the Italian authorities beforehand, and it's not exactly clear how much of what was delivered was of any use at all. You've had anonymous reporting that 80% plus of what arrived was completely useless, which if you dig into some of the figures that are publicly available does seem to be true. Meanwhile, the Italian government has not actually endorsed, but not actually neither endorsed nor criticized what's arrived. So investigative journalists digging into this in Italy have been threatened personally by the Russian government after questioning what has arrived. And meanwhile, the concurrent charm offensive has seen Russia paying Italians to sing the praises of Russia and criticize the EU for Russian domestic TV consumption. And just like with China, you have these manipulated videos which appear to show the Russian national anthem as well as the Chinese being played in Italian public squares as a gesture of support. So again, you've got this two-track approach of delivering what is described as aid but may not actually be that useful, and the secondary objective of riding on that for a disinformation campaign.
I mean, what you describe at the beginning there of Russian forces fundamentally landing unbidden and unannounced on Italian soil, it almost sounds like a military exercise. Perhaps there was another intent.
That's certainly how it is being treated by Russia, of course, as a training opportunity. But let's not forget that they treat the whole operation in Syria, that whole massive campaign, as a training opportunity. They have been busily refining their warfighting capability and testing their logistics, their people, their military equipment, even by using them for completely inappropriate purposes, just to see how they work under operational conditions for quite a few years now. So yes, it does present them with an opportunity, but I would certainly hope that they did not actually arrive quite as unexpectedly as they appeared to.
Yes, indeed. This is LNL on Radio National. Keir Giles is my guest. He's a senior consulting fellow of the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House in the UK. And Keir, it's not just Italy. Russia also sends medical equipment to New York.
That's right. Again, another murky story. Nobody has released information on what exactly was sent and what arrived, how much of it was found out to be useful. So again, you have nobody around the world that is receiving these Russian shipments actually saying, this is useful and thank you very much, with the exception, obviously, of President Trump. So what has been done with this this Russian military aircraft that arrived apparently full of loosely stacked cardboard boxes of something in New York just has not been publicized by the United States at all.
It's interesting, though, I mean, speaking of publicity and going back to Europe, you know, the videos of people singing Russian and Chinese national anthems, the success of that aspect of the campaign, the gullibility and I guess perhaps the culpability of Western media in running hard on that aspect of it. This plays into the hands of the plan makers within the Kremlin.
It doesn't help that it looks plausible and it is a good story, and it takes a lot more effort to actually dig into whether it is true or not than it does to just run with the story and say, look, here is a gesture of support for Russia. So countering disinformation, or indeed detecting disinformation in the first place, is hard work, and as a rule, it is not something which most newsrooms are set up for over and beyond just ordinary fact-checking. We've had a similar story here in the UK just over the last week, where it appeared that a network of social media profiles was using fake pictures from the National Health Service here to promote political messages. That in itself seems to be a fake story, a disinformation that was spun completely out of control by the media before anybody dug down into it to see exactly where it was coming from and discovered that there was nothing happening at all. So it's the same problem again. The pandemic is such fertile ground for people to be credulous.
It's not a golden moment for truth. What of the Russian interventions in Poland and Serbia? Has that gone down well?
Again, it is really hard to tell. Now, Serbia in particular is a great case study because, again, you have Russian military aircraft arriving, delivering something run by Russian military units, but the only information as to what they're up to is actually coming from Russia. So, again, you have a national government in Europe that has Russian troops on its soil, that has invited them, presumably, and is allowing them to operate, presumably, but is saying nothing about it. So it's completely impossible to judge just how much good they're doing and what, in fact, they're up to.
The arc of the pandemic in China is pretty well known, although, you know, there's significant questions about causality, and that's something which the world is going to want to explore. But within Russia now, we have a fairly muffled view, if I can mix my metaphor, of how COVID-19 is progressing within Russia. What do we know for sure?
Well, it is always hard to know for sure when it comes to Russia because they do have a domestic system which is so well at suppressing information which the authorities do not want to be widely known. We've got past the stage at least where Russia was saying that because they closed their borders with China early, they had the pandemic under control, and so there were very few cases and all of those were imported. That narrative has now passed by, especially since one of the main senior doctors that was promoting that himself came down with coronavirus a few days later. So it is known that the number of cases, at least the number of publicly reported cases, is rising and following a similar track to what we've seen elsewhere. But then there are so many areas of Russia where you will not get reliable reporting. There's an area in the north of Russia called Komi. It's not that remote by Russian standards, but it is a cold and miserable and fairly desolate place where the instincts of the local officials have been, as they always are in Russia, rather than ask for help, just pretend that nothing is happening and everything is fine, until, of course, it blows up in their faces. So you're relying on independent media and independent journalists, what are left of them within Russia, to get the story out about what's happening, but even they are having difficulty getting to reliable information about just what the infection rate is and how many fatalities there have been. Russia's really good at covering up fatalities because it had so much practice from all of its wars in Ukraine, Syria, and so on.
What's the official line? I mean, is the country, I mean, this is, you know, it's a vast entity, Russia, but is it to some extent locked down? Is it doing the things that the rest of the world is doing?
It is, to some extent. President Putin has taken a bit of a backseat on this because any measures that are taken towards lockdown are going to be unpopular. And so it's fallen on local mayors, regional governors, and so on to implement some of these measures to take the flak for interfering in people's lives. Now, overall, you have what appears to be a policy of transparency, but again, it's so hard to dig down and see exactly what is happening in the regions. Moscow, obviously, the place that imported most of the cases in the first place, and therefore one of the hardest hit localities in Russia, also benefits from by far the best healthcare facilities. Like many other things, as soon as you go beyond the Moscow Ring Road, the quality of stuff gets much, much worse. So the regions will be hit harder, and of course they are now complaining that these foreign aid efforts have diverted the equipment that they themselves need in order to engage in foreign policy adventures by the state.
Back to the geopolitics. I mean, the incapacitation by disease of the United States and its faintly chaotic absorption in the pandemic, that must present a tremendous opportunity.
You would have thought so. The question is how to exploit it. Now, Russia often doesn't move unless it's a kind of background noise of undermining and subverting foreign societies, unless they see a crisis which is getting rapidly worse. It's more often a stop-loss intervention that actually causes Russia to move in a big way, as was the case, for example, in Ukraine and in Syria. But you have this curious situation where it is hard to see how an external actor can exploit the situation that you have in the US administration at the moment to make it any worse than they're already making it on their own under Trump. So in a way, this is one of those situations where you can sit back, relax, and watch it go downhill rapidly without any external help.
When what is, you know, the situation in America is perhaps that is the manifestation of the Russian project. That is what they wanted to see occur, that sort of incapacity to deal is precisely on message.
Well, I think probably even the most enthusiastic Russian planner, when he was putting forward an idea to get President Trump elected, even in the most exuberant forecast, they wouldn't have foreseen digging mass graves for Americans because they've been so wiped out by a pandemic that President Trump obstructed responses to. I think that would have been beyond their wildest dreams.
When this finishes, we're going to have a significantly altered balance of power and influence globally. Where do China and Russia stand in that? What would be their ambitions in that post-pandemic world?
I think the ambitions remain unchanged. There are certain persistent things that both Russia and China have wanted from the West and the whole of the world. The question is, how much stronger will they be and how much more able to press for those things? A relationship between themselves, of course, will also be unchanged. It just may accelerate that difference in terms of Russia's decline and China's ascent to bring that crisis between the two countries, where they have to finally face up to the fact that what they want is incompatible with each other, even closer. So I think rather than making any fundamental shift in the long-term direction, it's really just speeding things up.
It's potentially not a pretty picture here.
Not at all. Unfortunately, in our business, dealing with Russia in particular, the pictures are rarely pretty.
Keir, thank you so much for your time and patient explanations.
Good night.
Keir Giles, he's a senior consulting fellow at the Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House in the UK. We'll pop a link on the LNL page on the RN website to his book. It's called Moscow Rules, What Drives Russia to Confront the West.